You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 6th of November 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show...
Until we determine the actual causes of what happened, I believe it's reasonable to suspend flights of Russian aviation to Egypt.
Russia joins the countries restricting flights to Egypt, with the most widespread suspension of all. Has Moscow also concluded that Islamic State bombed Flight 9268? And if so, then what? My guests James Schneider and Jane Kinnamont will be here to discuss that and the day's other top stories, including...
His comments about U.S. officials, including the president and Secretary Kerry, we believe were troubling and offensive. We obviously expect government officials from any country, especially our closest allies, to speak respectfully and truthfully about senior U.S. government officials.
A rough start and possibly an early conclusion to the career of Benjamin Netanyahu's new communications director. We'll also discuss the strongest suggestion yet that Islamic State have used and are using chemical weapons in Syria and Iraq. And as the Moscow Times goes from daily to weekly, the future of expat newspapers. That's all coming up on Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are James Schneider, senior correspondent at New African Magazine, and Jane Kinnamont, deputy head of the Middle East and North Africa program at Chatham House. Welcome both. We will start tonight in Sharm el-Sheikh, the airport of which is presently besieged by thousands of British tourists complaining that their holidays have been extended. It is likely to grow more chaotic following Russia's announcement that it is also suspending not only flights to Sharm el-Sheikh, but anywhere in Egypt. Several other countries have imposed various restrictions on flights to and from Egypt, including in some cases the forbidding of hold luggage. And adding to the confusion, some flights dispatched today to retrieve British tourists have turned around midway and come back. Jane, do we infer at this point that the UK has now shared with Russia whatever intelligence it had that it thought pointed to a bomb?
Whether that's happened directly or whether the Egyptians have done so isn't clear, but it does look like a pretty dramatic turnaround for Russia, which initially had been really quite sceptical about the UK accounts and had been arguing that they were very politicised.
James, do we also infer that everyone is now pretty much persuaded that Islamic State did blow this plane up?
Well, they're all acting as if they all have to act as if that is the case to take precautions, which doesn't necessarily mean that everyone is 100% sold that that's what happened. But they'd look very stupid if another thing happened again whilst they're still deliberating and going over the evidence. And it doesn't seem, at least obviously from the reports that I've seen, it doesn't seem like 100% firm evidence has been presented, but just it suggests that this, you know, it could have been a bomb in the luggage hold. So I think they will have to act as if it's the case, but that doesn't necessarily mean they are ruling anything else out.
Jane, as you pointed out, Russia has been quite sceptical or quite detached about any suggestions until now that the aircraft was bombed. But it has emerged also today that earlier this week, Monday, Tuesday, after the crash, there were the heaviest Russian strikes yet on Raqqa, Islamic State's nominal capital, killing at least 42 people, according to reports from within Syria. Does that strike you as a coincidence?
Russia's military intervention in Syria has put it right at the top of the target list for international jihadis, whether they swear allegiance to Islamic State or Al-Qaeda or others. People will have been competing to look for a spectacular and high-profile attack on Russian targets. Of course, there are risks inside Russia itself, particularly in Chechnya, but you have seen a whole range of clerics, including some 50 from Saudi Arabia, saying that the military intervention by Russia in Syria is a cause for violent jihad against them.
On that note, James, the Russian intervention in Syria, at least up until now, as far as it's ever possible to tell, has been reasonably popular in Russia. In fact, quite popular in Russia, and Vladimir Putin's ratings have climbed. If it turns out that this was a retaliation by Islamic State for that intervention, is it possible to imagine that there will be a Russian equivalent of that body of Western opinion there always is in such circumstances, which sort of frets that we've done something to deserve this and it was all our fault, really?
I wouldn't say that we've done something to deserve this. It's all our fault, really. But you will see, of course, when Russian bodies are brought home in body bags, that you know, will reduce the support for something. But we have to remember how Islamist terrorism is viewed in Russia. Russia has been a great victim of terrorist attacks, and does very much view itself as as part of the war on terror, just not the American-led bit of the war on terror. And so popular support for anti-terror actions and against terrorist groups is very strong. So I don't think there'll immediately be either a mea culpa or some people are coming home in body bags, therefore we're not sure about it, which stands in contrast to, say, the actions in Ukraine, where soldiers coming back dead does have a real effect on public opinion, because it's a war on which the ground is shakier for Russia. Whilst this is, it's a lot clearer, they know who the enemy is and they know they don't like them.
Jane, if it is eventually concluded, and it is still an if, that this was a bomb and that Islamic State planted it, it is obviously first and foremost a monstrous crime against Russia and the Russian people. But how big a disaster is that going to be for Egypt?
It's very bad because it will really have a massive economic ripple effect, which the many killings that have already taken place of Egyptians haven't had to such a degree. So to put it in context, over the past 2 years since the overthrow of the Muslim Brotherhood, the Egyptian authorities say that militants of various types fighting in the Sinai have killed several hundred police and security forces. You've seen a bomb at the Italian consulate in Cairo. You've seen a Croatian beheaded by Islamic State. You've seen the chief prosecutor assassinated. But the rest of the world doesn't pay that much attention until international tourists are involved and people start thinking, this could be us. You have 10 million tourists a year going to Egypt. So that's a lot of people who think it could be them.
But it's especially this context of Sharm el-Sheikh, isn't it? Because that was the resort that was always sold, with a subliminal undertone of, Egypt can be a bit rickety from time to time, but really Sharm el-Sheikh is entirely safe. It's like being in on the Costa del Sol with better weather.
That's the perception. In fact, about 10 years ago, there were a string of bombings in Sharm el-Sheikh hotels.
True enough.
But tourism actually recovered very quickly. It would typically be the case that for a couple of months, tourists wouldn't come, hotels would slash prices, holidaymakers would come back, perhaps not even knowing that there had been bombs very recently.
James, final thought on this one before we move along. It seems a slightly gauche consideration, but I'm sure it's one Egypt will be making. Is there a PR strategy that gets you through this? Is there a way that Egypt can or should act that might actually reassure people thinking of holidaying there and protect whatever might remain of its tourist economy after this?
Don't hire the advertising agency that did Tunisia's after the Tunisian Revolution. Do you remember that advertising campaign? They're on London buses, and it was someone getting a massage, and it said, "They say that the security forces in Tunisia are heavy-handed." So don't hire those people.
Yeah, okay.
And try to avoid all the terrible criticisms for being a dictator when you go on foreign trips. Those would be the two bits of advice, maybe.
They will emphasise that this kind of attack could happen anywhere. They will say this kind of violence is a global threat. You've seen the same thing happen in Tunisia, despite the very different politics there.
You've seen the same thing happen in London and Madrid for that.
They might look back to Lockerbie and say, this kind of disaster can happen anywhere, which they can keep saying as long as it's a one-off.
But they can't quite keep on saying that, given that all of Sisi's other policies and the way in which he relates to the world is based on the fact that he's keeping a lid on terrorism, and he's, his harsh security measures are needed because of this kind of threat. So it's a funny kind of dual game. He's got to say this is a global problem, but also there's a terrible local specificity, so you've got to give me more arms and you've got to give me diplomatic cover.
There were already signs that wasn't the case. Take the incident in September where Egyptian military airstrikes ended up killing a number of Mexican tourists in the Sinai while they were having lunch, which initially was claimed to be an operation against jihadis until the tour company basically revealed that they were Mexican tourists.
Okay, well, let's move along now to Syria itself. And it is pretty difficult at this point to imagine the action by Islamic State which would render them even less endearing to civilised opinion. But Islamic State themselves have spared us the trouble. A report by the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons has concluded that on August 21st, in a battle between IS and another rebel group, at least two people were exposed to mustard gas. James, first of all, the OPCW is not mandated to assign blame, but it's fairly clear from the tone of their report and what sources close to the report have said that they believe that Islamic State has either found a way to make this stuff or has acquired remnants of Syria's allegedly decommissioned chemical weapons stockpile. How big a deal is this? If true.
Yeah, if true, and then we don't know how much. I mean, obviously, if they have chemical weapons, they're going to use them. It's not like the Islamic State follows any international legal convention in any way, shape or form. So it could have effect, but who knows? I've got absolutely no idea how much of the stuff, if they have it, they have it. But I think if they do have it, we can be pretty sure they're going to use it.
Well, yeah, Kurdish authorities have also claimed that IS launched mustard gas at Peshmerga positions in Iraq. Jane, there was this initiative a couple of years ago, widely hailed as a slight glimmer amid the darkness of Syria, that the regime was pressured one way or another into handing over its chemical weapons stockpile. Rather, 1,400 tons of the stuff was handed over. It was probably always hoping a bit much that not absolutely all of it. That absolutely all of it would be accounted for. But at this point, does it actually make any difference to the way that the rest of the world reacts to the Syrian conflict? The world did not react infamously a couple of years ago when it seemed very clear that the regime had used sarin gas. The world has not reacted since to various reports of chlorine. Really? Is this the so-called fabled red line?
The question is, what sort of reaction? I mean, countless countries are now bombing Islamic State, whether it's in Iraq or in Syria. At least the confiscation of Syrian chemical weapons a couple of years ago probably is one of the few non-disastrous bits of policy towards Syria, because it will have at least reduced the quantities of extremely dangerous weapons that Islamic State and other fighting groups could potentially get their hands on. But there is a worry too as to whether that might have an impact as well on regime behaviour, and whether the regime could potentially again turn to some of these weapons or start manufacturing more.
James, as you pointed out, you're quite right. Islamic State clearly don't regard themselves bound by any international agreements on the laws of war, or even, you could argue, elementary standards of decency. Is this just, if we are seeing use of chemical weapons by various sides in or various parties to the Syrian conflict, is this, I guess, an inevitable consequence of the fact that the world has clearly no real wish to get meaningfully involved in this, and that people have realised that you can basically do as you like, that this has become, you know, this ghastly sort of Hobbesian arena in which there's no particular law but force?
It depends on your definition of meaningfully, but I mean, if you mean effectively, then yes.
Effectively, yeah, would have been a better choice of word.
But I mean, because obviously lots is going on, but yes, I don't think that even if what was going on against ISIS was more effective than what it was, ISIS would think, well, we're not going to use chemical weapons because we're really, that's the one that's really going to push us over the edge when we eventually end up in some court, or that will really strengthen public opinion when they're doing things like burning pilots alive and filming it and putting, you know, I can't see how it would factor into their calculations. This is just another ghastly weapon in their arsenal, where violence and the way in which they do violence and the way in which they publicise their violence is part of their strategy.
What do you think, Jane? Because chemical weapons were supposed to be a red line, we were told, and then it turned out that line was no longer quite as, or not quite as red or as starkly drawn as we might have been led to believe. Is the West at some level culpable for the fact that clearly almost everybody involved in the conflict in Syria thinks they can do absolutely anything to anybody else and there'll be no consequence?
Perhaps culpable for allowing the regime to believe that it could escalate violence without really fearing very much at all from the West. If you look back at the early days, the Syrian regime seemed to test the boundaries with violence and gradually escalated. But after it became clear there wouldn't be any military intervention, it did seem to have a bit more of a free hand. I don't see that Western military intervention increasing in terms of ground troops would be something that would deter Islamic State from using whatever they can get their hands on in the context of this extremely brutal conflict.
I mean, James, what you were saying there is quite true. The sort of frankly imaginative depths of depravity that Islamic State have already not only plumbed but actually boasted about does make any kind of, I guess, invocation of morality somewhat idle. But is it even possible to imagine at this point the development in Syria that would actually enrage global opinion to the extent that the impetus to actually do something effective, as you put it, if indeed there's anything to be effective to be done, would become irresistible? How have we got so beyond outrage at Syria?
I think it's what you said, if there were anything effective to be done, as if there is some coalition of forces outside that could magically fix something, that the West was able to somehow fix this problem. I think, first of all, We have to recognise that, I mean, it's not even that ISIS don't have the same sort of levels of decency or the same understanding of international law. Their understanding of time and of history is rather different. So for them, this is in an apocalyptic moment, and these additional spikes of violence points them towards the end times and towards which is what they want, and towards their big final battle in Darbik and so on and so forth. So In that case, your normal show of strength doesn't limit them in any way. It doesn't make them think, oh, well, we've got to maybe think again and regroup and try to sue for peace in some way. The only thing I can imagine working is some incredibly grand, incredibly broad settlement that brings together all of the external forces that have any role whatsoever. And that seems to be a precondition for sorting things out internally. But that's a lot of the calls for action. Something must be done. The Russian intervention, the intervention by Britain in Iraq, by the US-led coalition in Iraq and Syria, and so on. All of these often detract from that bringing everybody together, which it seems to be in some way necessary. However distasteful it is to sit down with, let's say, Iran, who have been supporting Assad, who, as we know, has killed his own people. However horrible all of that is, it seems that's going to be the precondition, because otherwise all of those incredibly difficult internal dynamics won't be dealt with, and they'll all get stoked up as proxies, as we've been seeing over the last few years.
Jane, final thought on this one from you. I guess an expansion on what James was discussing there, because when I attempt optimism about Syria, that's the direction I go down as well. The fact that that Islamic State have managed to revolt global opinion, that it is pretty much the one thing that every party to the war in Syria appears to agree on. Is it possible that group of strange bedfellows could actually be brought together, that you could actually see countries like Turkey, Russia, the United States, Iran, Saudi Arabia actually deciding, okay, whatever else we might disagree on, we can actually agree on this?
Yes, it's one of the few areas of common ground that all the states in the region and internationally want to prevent Syria from being a long-term haven for groups that are ultimately going to attack all of these other states. And you are now seeing the beginnings of a diplomatic process that does involve Russia, the US, European powers and the regional powers. That's very important, but it should have happened years ago. The problem is that this international focus on Islamic State leaves out the fact that the Syrian people, if there's no single representative of the Syrian people, but there's virtually no voice for them in this international diplomacy. In general, they probably do not share the view that the Islamic State is the number one enemy. Ultimately, the Syrian government has killed more people than Islamic State, and there are a number of other militias that have also carried out some pretty nasty violence. So they will see the international talks as something that represents foreign interests yet again and gives them very little control over their own destiny.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Miller, along with Jane Kinnamont and James Schneider. Coming up next, how to lose friends and irritate people with Benjamin Netanyahu's recently appointed and probably imminently fired new communications director.
The Big Interview is back, the show that brings you the fascinating life stories of some of the most influential people in the worlds of art and culture, business and design, returns for a new season here on Monocle 24.
Nobody wants a star to be different. They want them to be the same all the time. That's anathema to me. I've always wanted to be different. I look different, sound different, think differently, walk differently. And I still want that.
This week, British theatre actor turned Hollywood icon Ian McKellen in conversation with Robert Bound.
I could talk about it and wanted to on behalf of other people who weren't as lucky as I was. And I've gone on doing that. So I've found the best part I've ever played, really. She's being an openly gay man.
The Big Interview with Ian McKellen premieres Sunday at 9 a.m. London time on Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, on Monocle 24. Still with me are James Schneider and Jane Kinnenmont. Now, there are probably few more challenging posts in political life than serving as communications director for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, a polarising leader of a polarising country. However, a certain amount of trouble can probably be avoided by observing a few basic rules, such as make sure your social media is cleansed of suggestions that the President of the United States is an anti-Semite, or insinuations that the US Secretary of State is an imbecile. The latest appointee to the gig, Ran Baratz, has been found to have flouted this one. His position is now, and I quote, under review. James, how does someone who's managed to reach a senior position in politics make such a bizarre, absurd, ill-advised choice as communications director?
I have absolutely no idea. The Israelis have a number of extremely good spokespeople. Mark Regev has been the foreign ministry spokesperson for a long time. I think he's moved on to be an ambassador somewhere, but he's extremely good. There was a British-born guy during the Gaza war who was the IDF's chief spokesman. His name escapes me, but he was extremely compelling. You know, was very good at dealing with very hostile, difficult positions. Basically, communicating what Netanyahu was saying to generally a hostile audience. So I've got absolutely no idea why he's gone for this guy who earlier this year was saying, somewhat ill-advised, but completely, completely stupid things. Regardless of, what I think about the performance of John Kerry as Secretary of State, I mean, still really stupid things.
Jane, this is all terrifically amusing, obviously. Is it really, in the grand scheme of things, a big deal or just one of those minor embarrassments at which sort of, radio discussion shows we'll have a brief chuckle at and the world will turn?
Well, I think on our show today, compared to everything else, it's been the light relief.
Well, indeed so.
Well, it does tell you something about the political discourse in Israel. I mean, Israeli politics is a bit like Australian politics in that people are straight talking to the point of rude. They don't count.
Straight talking is the tactful way of describing it.
Straight talking
yes.
is the British way of being rude about it, whereas in Israel people tend to be much more frank and brusque. But there is a widespread narrative that criticism of Israel in general is anti-Semitic. This is something that is very widely believed, and usually when the Israeli government talks about things like the growing boycott, divestment and sanctions movement, they frame that as something that is simply anti-Semitism.
Do you think it's actually widely believed? By which I mean, do you think that when they float that one, they actually believe it, or are they just think this is an effective way of just shutting the debate down?
I think it's a bit of both, but I think there is a very deep... understandably, there is a very deep anxiety inside Israel about anti-Semitism because of the historic experience of the people there. So it is something that people are extremely, extremely sensitive to. And when the government talks about it, that really does resonate with the population.
There is possibly a serious point here, which is, of course, that whoever occupies the job of Prime Minister of Israel is somebody who's going to have to make a great deal of very difficult, very sensitive decisions. Between this and sort of, I guess, Netanyahu's most recent peculiar outburst, in which he accused the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem circa 1942 for having given Hitler the idea for the Holocaust. James, is there a steady hand on the tiller, I guess? Has he been in the job too long? Might be another question, another way of putting it.
It's far from me to say. I mean, I would think so, but then I'm not exactly his political bedfellow. But the thing that is interesting about these public comments and spokespeople having lies before and all the rest of it, I think we're seeing this coming up more and more in politics. As politicians have social media accounts, they develop followings, they are praised for engaging with people on a kind of more, on a less censored way. And these kind of stories, I think we're going to see come up more and more, where people's previous comments taken in a completely different context are going to come up and are going to hurt them a lot. I mean, although his seemed to be particularly stupid.
The lesson, never say anything. Finally tonight, it's generally hard to regard it as good news when any newspaper decides to publish less frequently, but it does seem an especial loss in Russia, a media environment not overrun with reliable or independent publications. Since 1992, the Moscow Times has done a solid enough job of explaining the world to Russia and Russia to the world in English, but its new owner has announced that the paper, which does operate at a loss, will henceforth become a weekly. Jane, first of all, the English language newspaper for expats, and having been, I am, to my great regret, a monoglot. I only speak English, and some would suggest I do that erratically, but I've been very reliant when travelling as a journalist on English language newspapers in parts foreign. But are these one of these things that the internet has made kind of redundant?
Arguably, the internet has made them more useful, at least in being able to reach an international audience, but that isn't an audience you can easily monetize. You, in countries where you've got a growing middle class, growing education system, growing number of people who want to go and study in the West, you also have a growing number of second language English speakers who might turn to some of these papers if they think that they're more credible. What you've tended to see in the area that I focus on, in the Middle East, is actually an increasing number of Arabic language publications and international outlets going for Arabic language editions, especially in the TV broadcasting space.
Middle Eastern countries did also have that tradition of official or semi-official English language newspapers, which I did used to enjoy as a point of style, because they were just so fantastically boring that you ended up being kind of impressed that they'd managed to stay awake while they were writing the article, which I think was the Libya Times or the Tripoli Times back in the under Gaddafi was... Oh, it was splendid. It really, really was.
They're still going. One of my favourite was from Bahrain's little-known Gulf Daily News, which had a great report about the king sending a cable of congratulations to Sheikha Sabika, who happens to be his wife.
Ah, that's splendid. James, is there an argument that maybe, a weekly in the current media environment is actually more effective as well as more cost-efficient than a daily? Because if you're trying to do a daily newspaper, you're going to get stuffed by the internet absolutely every time. You are, by definition, publishing yesterday's news. But ideally, can a weekly sort of do the broader view, take the step back?
Well, I would hope so. And I think in the case of expat newspapers, so they do have a specific role, which is something that other newspapers can't give them. But perhaps they don't need to be doing that every day, and people don't need to get their news from it. But I think, I don't know enough about the details around the Moscow Times going weekly, but I would have thought there's quite a lot of it isn't just to do with like the general trends that you see in expat newspapers, and a lot of it to do with the complete shutting down of the media environment in Russia and the attacks on the media and sort of harassment of the publication.
It is at least partly to do with a law introduced last year, I think I'm right in saying, which meant that foreigners can no longer own more than a 20% stake in Russian media outlets. It was owned by a Finnish publisher.
Yeah, which killed their, I can't remember what it was called, but the it was meant to be the business newspaper, which was part-owned by the FT, which was meant to be, I can't remember what it was called, it's meant to be pretty good, and it got killed by the fact that it had the FT and, I think, German ownership as well.
Jane, just a final thought on this from you, as the clock is against us. Where does one go, or as far as you're aware, for actual reliable news about Russia these days? It has created this own sort of bizarre hall of mirrors by way of a media environment.
That's right. It's increasingly difficult, and I think you see more and more people turning to the least reliable outlets, the Russian state-funded ones, which are getting increasing numbers of viewers and listeners around the world.
We will have to leave it there. Jane Kinnamont and James Schneider, thank you very much both for joining us on Midori House. That is all for today's episode. It was produced by Carlotta Ribello, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Jamie Waters. Our studio manager was Toby Hammond. For the next half hour, Carlotta will be sticking around to keep you company with Monocle's international playlist. Marcus Hippie follows with the menu at 1900. At 2200 is the Monocle Daily. Midori House returns on Monday at 1800 London time. But for this edition, it's goodbye. Thanks for listening and have a good weekend.